From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Clearly, the convictions of the five men who served time for the Central Park jogger rape were unjust and calls into question our criminal justice system and its fairness, especially to young men of color.
DNA tests indicate police arrested the wrong people in the Central Park jogger case. We'll talk with a New York City council member who's representing the families and the lawyers who may sue. They're calling for a review. Then, we'll take a look at the case in Florida where the NAACP settled with the state along with the private company ChoicePoint. But thousands of voters illegally purged from the rolls still can't vote. But first, Howard Zinn on the 300 members of Congress who are coming to Federal Hall in New York today. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. About 100 U.S. and British warplanes attacked Iraq last night in the biggest single operation in 4 years. According to the London Telegraph, the raid on major Western air defense installations looks like it was designed to destroy air defenses in order to allow special forces helicopters from Jordan or Saudi Arabia to hunt down Scud missiles ahead of a full-scale invasion. Meanwhile, Pentagon officials say the Army has recently doubled the size of its war stocks in Kuwait to accommodate a little-noticed expansion of U.S. armored forces at a base near the Iraqi border. Army Secretary Thomas White of Enron scandal fame said the Army is ready for whatever action President Bush chooses. And Vice President Dick Cheney and CIA Director George Tenet gave congressional leaders a top secret briefing on why the U.S. would attack Iraq. President Bush took his case for war with Iraq to the heartlands yesterday, telling rallies in Kentucky and Indiana that history has, quote, called us into action to topple the Iraqi leader. He plans to call the leaders of Russia, France, and China today. Those nations all hold the power of veto on the UN Security Council. He's scheduled to meet with British Prime Minister Tony Blair at Camp David Saturday. Blair told the BBC Britain is willing to pay a blood price in its special relationship with the U.S. and will be there when the shooting starts. Bush is also scheduled to address the UN General Assembly on September 12th. As the Bush administration's war preparations gain momentum, NATO officials say NATO will not participate in any preemptive strike on Iraq because offensive action runs contrary to the founding principles of the North Atlantic Alliance. And the foreign ministers from 20 Arab nations ended 2 days of talks in Cairo. They issued a resolution declaring their, quote, total rejection of the threat of aggression on Arab nations, in particular Iraq, reaffirming that these threats to the security and safety of any Arab country are considered a threat to Arab national security, unquote. The Arab League chief, Amr Moussa, warned that a war would open the gates of hell for the Middle East. The Cairo meeting is in sharp contrast to the broad Arab and international participation in the 1991 Gulf War to evict Iraq from its oil-rich neighbor, Kuwait. Afghan President Hamid Karzai survived an assassination attempt in Kandahar just hours yesterday after a car bomb killed 25 people 300 miles away in Kabul. Shots fired into Karzai's car came within inches of the president and injured the governor of Kandahar. Afghan officials immediately blamed al-Qaeda and the Taliban and said the attacks appear to have been timed around the anniversary of the September 11th attacks in the United States, but the officials acknowledge they have no evidence. The attacks follow reports that remnants of the Taliban and al-Qaeda have been reorganizing and rearming, but they also come amid growing anti-American sentiment in the country following the killings of hundreds of civilians in raids by U.S. warplanes. The New York Times reports there have been growing fears that a warlord who once destroyed half of Kabul could be again about to open new attacks. Hekmatyar had been in exile in Iran during the Taliban years, but returned recently to the Kabul region and vowed to join al-Qaeda and the Taliban in a new jihad. The New York Times did not mention that Hekmatyar was the top recipient of covert U.S. and Saudi funds in the 1980s. International peacekeeping forces operate only in Kabul, leaving Kandahar and other cities to warlords. U.S. troops do not participate in peacekeeping operations. For months, the Pentagon has ignored repeated calls from the Afghan government around the world to expand the peacekeeping forces. Today in New York, 300 U.S. lawmakers will meet in a special joint session to mark the first anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Congress hasn't convened in the city in over 200 years. Today's session will take place at Federal Hall. The hall is located on the site where the first Congress met, where the Bill of Rights was written, and where George Washington was inaugurated in 1790 as the first president of the United States. Howard Zinn joins us on the phone, a historian who's author of People's History of the United States. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Howard.
Oh, thank you, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. I'm here with Juan.
Howard Zinn, I'd like to ask you your impressions on this this historic gathering here of the members of Congress in the midst of this perpetual war now that we're involved in.
I think it's good to commemorate the bravery of those firemen and policemen and medical workers and all, and people in the Twin Towers who work to save the lives of other people. I mean, those are the things that we should be commemorating, that kind of courage. But I don't find any courage in Congress. And therefore, Congress is the last body on earth I could imagine to commemorate that event. Congress does not have, you know, the kind of record that can make us proud of our legislative body. And I mean, Congress, on the one hand, you have this, you know, the courage of the people involved in saving people, and on the other hand, you have the absolute cowardice of Congress in going along with President Bush and replying to September 11th, you know, with only the motive of revenge and retaliation and war, and that kind of behavior on the part of Congress does not make me proud of it, and does not make me want it. Want me to have Congress represent me on an occasion like this.
What about it being the site of where the Bill of Rights was written?
Another irony. Congress is nothing but ironic in almost everything it does. And, ironic that it's meeting on the site of the drafting of the Bill of Rights when Congress has ignored the Bill of Rights in passing the Patriot Act, which sort of drives wedges into the Bill of Rights and cuts it apart. And, you know, Congress, which sits idly by while the Attorney General of the United States takes upon himself, you know, kind of Gestapo-like powers to round up people and detain them and violate the constitutional rights of both non-citizens and citizens. So, for Congress to meet there, maybe it's the only value of it is to remind us how the Bill of Rights has been ignored by this particular Congress.
Well, it's also significant to note that they'll be right across the street from the stock exchange. That might be more significant. And Dick Cheney, the vice president, will preside over the joint session of Congress, who is currently being investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission for his tenure as a head of Halliburton, the oil services company.
Yeah. Congress should be meeting in the stock exchange. I mean, that would be appropriate. And relations between Congress and Wall Street, between Congress and American corporations, you know, has always been an extremely friendly one, beneficial to both sides. I think, you know, that would be, you know, a very good thing for Congress to do. I understand that there's going to be a rally at Wall Street on September 11th with Ralph Nader and other people sort of pointing out the connection between corporate wealth represented by Wall Street and the actions of our government in perpetuating war.
Well, Howard Zinn, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, well, thanks for doing the job you're doing, Amy.
And thank you, Juan. Thank you. As we move on with headlines, former President Jimmy Carter slammed the Bush administration's so-called war on terrorism in an opinion piece in yesterday's Washington Post. In the piece entitled "The Troubling New Face of America," Carter writes, "Our country has become the foremost target of respected international organizations concerned about basic principles of democratic life." Carter writes, "We have ignored or condoned abuses in nations that support our anti-terrorism effort while detaining American citizens as enemy combatants, incarcerating them secretly and indefinitely without their being charged with any crime or having the right to legal counsel." Carter also expressed concern over Bush's rejection of nuclear arms agreements, the Biological Weapons Convention, environmental protection, anti-torture proposals, and the International Criminal Court. And Israeli troops shot dead two Palestinians early this morning in Jenin, attacked a metal factory in the Gaza Strip, and announced plans to demolish four homes in Jerusalem owned by relatives of alleged terrorists. On Thursday, Palestinians destroyed a tank and killed two soldiers in the Gaza Strip. And a vehicle packed with about half a ton of explosives was seized by police officers in Israel, averting an attack that the Israeli police say could have killed and wounded hundreds of people. And finally, here in the United States, last night in New Jersey, the Green Party candidate for U.S. Senate was arrested as he tried to enter the television studio where the Democratic and Republican candidates were holding a debate. The Green candidate is Ted Glick. He was barred from participating or even being in the audience during the debate. He joins us on the line. Ted Glick, can you tell us what happened?
Actually, there was no audience at all at this debate. It's a real metaphor for the exclusion of the public, really, from the political process. I attempted to get in to observe the other two candidates since it was clear they were not going to include me, so that I could then afterwards make comments to the press or anybody else about what I thought about the issues that they didn't address or the positions that they took that I disagreed with. And because I insisted on that, I was arrested and charged with criminal trespassing. I'm scheduled to go to trial or go to court October 1st. We are planning future protests at future debates if we continue to be excluded. People can find out more about this ongoing campaign for democracy in New Jersey at our website, which is glickforsenate.org.
Ted Glick, the Green Party candidate for Senate in New Jersey. You're listening to Democracy Now!
I'd like to reach far beyond the haze. Touch the common bond between the races, a golden thread, every heart connecting, a brotherhood behind the different faces. We'll only know the true light of freedom when every human soul has seen its beacon. Now we must go, following our reason. Love will lead the way to this new season. One world, who dares to dream? The greatest of the least of us to hold in high esteem. One world, can we conceive? Within the fabric that we weave, we become a family. One world, when will we see? How long will it take for us to learn to live in peace? One world, we plant the seed. Let us agree to disagree at the table peacefully. One world, who dares to dream? The greatest of the least of us.
One World, the Eclipse Band, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. By the way, welcome, Juan.
And welcome to all of our listeners around the country and viewers.
Well, attorneys for the original defendants in the infamous Central Park jogger case held a news conference yesterday calling for a reversal of the convictions now that new evidence has emerged. It was a case that rocked the city. In April 1989, a jogger in Central Park was raped, beaten, and left for dead. Five African-American and Latino teenagers were convicted. They served many years in jail. The last one just got out of prison several weeks ago after serving 13 years. At the time, the headlines screamed Wolfpack, Wilding, teenagers singing Wilding songs in jail.
It may well have been a deciding factor in the New York State Legislature's decision to reestablish the death penalty in the state. Shortly after the attack, Donald Trump took out full-page ads in all the New York papers calling for bringing back the death penalty and referring to the young defendants in the jogger case as candidates for execution. In the news that was barely reported just last January, convicted rapist Matias Reyes unexpectedly confessed to the crime. He said he did it alone. Several months later, DNA tests showed that Reyes proved beyond question that he raped the jogger, according to a law enforcement official quoted in the New York Times. The first hearing on the case will be Monday. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office said it is reviewing the case.
And we're joined today in the studio by the lawyer for three of the men who were convicted. Michael Tarif Warren is with us. On the telephone, Roger Wareham, who is a co-attorney in this case. And also in the studio with us is New York City Council member Bill Perkins, who is an advisor to all of the families involved. Now, just to clarify, Matias Reyes, the man who has come forward now, was never named in this case, but he is a man who was responsible for and convicted of three rapes and a murder soon after the Central Park jogger was attacked. It was in the same area. It was a string of rapes and finally a murder. Let's start with Michael Tarif Warren, this case, and what is the evolution of all this information?
Well, I think the evolution is when you take it from the trial, essentially at the trial, what we knew all along is that the only thing the prosecution had was a manipulated, coerced series of confessions from various of these young boys at the time. I think it's important to note that the confessions themselves were inherently contradictory. Each one of them contradicted, had internal contradictions, but they contradicted each other. For example, one of them was supposed to have said that the alleged rape took, and this is after many hours of grueling questions based on a script that these experienced detectives use when they interrogated them. One of them said that it occurred on the reservoir, for example. Another one said, no, it occurred way north of the reservoir. There were all type of contradictions. That's just one example. So you basically had a prosecution that was rested on coerced confessions. But beyond that, nothing else. There was no forensic comparison to these young boys. There was no DNA comparison. There was no serological comparison. There was no identification by not only the female jogger victim, but any of the others that they lumped into this so-called a pot of stew for purposes of obtaining a conviction, not only with respect to the jogger, but other individuals who were allegedly attacked that night in the park.
Well, Michael, I remember very much of that case.
Sure.
In fact, I covered aspects of the trial for the Daily News, and I remember, as many reporters were then, feeling extremely uneasy about the whole the lynch mentality that was prevalent in the city. But also, we went into court and we watched videotaped confessions.
Yes.
Of the teenagers. And I remember, I don't remember which teenager it was at that particular day that I was in the courtroom, seeing a youngster who clearly was very hardly able to verbalize.
Yes.
What he claimed was happening, but he did admit to being there. And now we're having this convicted rapist and murderer come forward and say, yes, I was there, and I did it alone.
And he did it alone. And beyond that, there has been DNA testing of his DNA and his blood. And his DNA alone matched the semen that was found in the vagina of the victim.
And at the time, even in court, it was said that the DNA matched none of the young people who had been charged.
Absolutely. It matched none of the young people who were charged. And there was a DNA extraction of the semen swab. And, of course, there was, as a result of that test, there was a single band DNA profile that was produced. But more importantly, it did not match any of these young boys. They attempted to say that was not enough of a profile. It was not until they conducted a second testing on the sperm that was on the sock that was recovered. And even though that was a single band as well, that conclusively matched the single band in the first instance in the sperm on the semen swab. So they had to confess at that point that in fact there was enough of a profile, and more importantly that there was no match to any of these young boys.
You know, I remember what happened afterwards very well, aside from this case.
Sure.
Because in the case of Matias Reyes, the man who has now come forward, he raped a woman in my building. This was right near the rape of the Central Park jogger. There had been a series of rapes in our neighborhood. In fact, one was a rape murder of a young pregnant mother who apparently he had come in, her two little kids were with her, and he said, "Your life or your eyes." He raped and killed her. He raped another woman, and then he came to our building, and as he finished raping her, he was ransacking the apartment. She raced downstairs screaming, and the doorman, John Ryan, tackled him. It wasn't the police who found him. It was the doorman. They got him, and the police then came and got Matias Reyes. Now, clearly, they had DNA testing at the time. Clearly, this man was convicted. He's now serving a life sentence at Attica.
That's right.
The M.O. seemed the same. Was there any connection made at the time?
There was no connection made, and that is one of our arguments. Our argument is that less than 4 to 5 months after these young boys were arrested, you had Matias Reyes arrested in the same area. He committed crimes in the same area. And, of course, it's laid out in a book by Harlan Levy and The Blood Cried Out. And Harlan Levy was the prosecutor in Mr. Reyes' case. And that case was also before Judge Galligan, who was the same judge that presided over the Central Park case. And of course, these experienced sex crimes prosecutors who interrogated Mr. Reyes, and not only sex crimes, but homicide prosecutors, you know, who were experienced, they found out after one initial admission that he had a profile. And his profile was, number one, not to operate with other individuals. He was a solo act. And number two, it was the same M.O. in terms of what he did to his victims that was done to the Central Park jogger.
We have to break for stations to identify this. As we come back, we'll continue this conversation. We're talking to Michael Warren. We're joined by New York City Councilmember Bill Perkins, and on the line with us, Roger Wareham, another attorney representing the young men who've now come out of prison, some serving up to 13 years. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back with us in a minute.
Prisons like a hole in the head. A prison is a home for the living dead. It is time for us to recognize that every man must be free if we really want to see eternity. Understanding that the spirit is a prime source of life that can only be stifled when put behind bars. We must all have an opportunity to shine like stars. Prisons like a hole in the head. Prisons create living dead. Prisons create living dead.
More Prisons, Cool DJ EQ Feet, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, talking about the Central Park jogger case and the calls to reopen this case, to review it, now that new evidence has come out linking a man who was never charged in the case, Matias Reyes, who's serving a life sentence in prison at Attica, with this case. He came forward, found religion, confessed, then they did a DNA test, and the DNA test is a positive match between him and the semen sample on the sock of the Central Park jogger who was raped and attacked in April of 1989.
Well, I'd like to continue with Councilman Perkins talking about, for those people who are from outside of New York who maybe are not familiar with this case, what the public hysteria and the rush to judgment, what the climate was at the time. You were then not even in city council. You were a district leader from the neighborhood, East Harlem and Schomburg Plaza area, where many of these young youngsters lived.
These were my neighbors, and I was very active in the area of Harlem, East Harlem, as a community leader. And when this event took place, it was a very racially charged atmosphere in the city at the time. And one of the terms that came out at that time, which you didn't mention, was the term urban terrorists. At the time, there was a...
And wolf packs,
and
right?
Wolf packs, urban terrorists. Koch said wolf pack. Dinkins said urban terrorists. And Koch said wilding. And the whole atmosphere was very charged. There was a very high-profile primary election going on between Dave Dinkins and Ed Koch. And so they were sort of trading epithets to more or less disassociate themselves or appeal to voters or whatever at the time. And it was very, very unfortunate because the New York Post and other media began to promote this as a very racially charged kind of incident, a young white woman being attacked by black and Latino men, defenseless, so on and so forth. So it was a very, very bad atmosphere. The young men, for the most part, were going to be tried through the press, tried, convicted, and prosecuted through the press, with Donald Trump coming up with the ultimate sentence of death when he took out an ad in the New York Times, a full-page ad in the New York Times, calling for the return of the death penalty.
And I remember in the Daily News where I worked, one of my colleagues, Mike McAlary, who was a good friend of mine, who's since deceased, but who we had many differences on these kinds of issues. And Mike wrote several columns about how the teenagers supposedly laughed and joked about the crime while they were being interviewed or interrogated by detectives in the Central Park precinct. And that really inflamed the city even more, that people were thinking, here were these teenagers who had so little value for life that after beating this and raping this woman and beating her nearly to death, were joking about it afterwards. And of course now, as we're beginning to look back, we begin to see how much of this was either totally fabricated or planted evidence by detectives leaking information to reporters who then went along and wrote it without any kind of other corroboration.
Well, the media again played a very, very significant role in not only the general public's perception of this, but I think in promoting the strategy that perhaps the DA's office or the police department, whatever the appropriate authorities were, to script a conviction, to script a horrible rape by these so-called urban terrorists, these so-called wolf pack.
And also, in line with that one,
Michael Warren.
If you look at the fourth chapter in this book by Harlan Levy, the prosecutor of Matias Reyes, The Blood Cries Out, he talks about, he describes Elizabeth Lederer, who is one of the prosecutors in the Central Park case along with Linda Fairstein, and he describes her as a big-eyed woman who is always in control, always maintaining control over herself. However, after the DNA test came back from the FBI, she was out of control, as described by him in the book. And she called him to his office. He went to her office, and she was extremely upset. And she was upset because she felt that as though they had a serious problem. the serious problem is that they didn't have any evidence against these kids. And he goes on to describe how there were internal contradictions within the statements themselves were taken by the cops as a result of the scripting process that these detectives entered into. And so they essentially had no case. So they had to engage in what appears to, as we lawyers like to think, a conspiracy. I don't know if they call it a conspiracy, but they talked about ways of getting around these problems, and they focused in on trying to make these confessions believable. And of course, the media account or the media coverage of the day also served as a further basis for the ultimate conviction of these young boys.
I want to bring Attorney Roger Wareham into this conversation. I'm looking at a quote from a retired NYPD detective, John Baeza. He was quoted in a piece by Sarah Wallace on WABC a couple of months ago. It says, "In this case, it's clear what they should have done. They should have continued to look for the suspect who left the semen at the crime scene." He goes on to say, "Yeah, somebody did drop the ball. A woman was killed because somebody slipped through the net. It's not pointing a finger at anyone in particular. One of the main things is that the police department's culture back then is 100% different than what it is now. Back then, unapprehended perpetrators were not really sought. Cases were closed, and that was it." He finally says, "The fact they're very quiet about this and that they're holding back on it can only mean to me two things. One, this individual is in jail now exonerating others. That may be a problem for them, so that's why they want to keep it quiet. Or the fact that this was the same individual a few months after the Central Park case went out to rape and murder a pregnant woman." Roger Wareham, what are the prosecutors saying right now?
So the prosecutors are saying that they're investigating. The prosecutors have known about this this evidence since January of this year. They're saying they're conducting an expeditious and thorough investigation. As we pointed out at the press conference yesterday, our concern is that this is not so much an investigation as a cover-up, and I think the points that you just quoted are very germane. There was another quote, I think, yesterday in, I think it was in Juan's paper, the Daily News, where they say, well, we always thought there was an unapprehended sixth person, because now they're trying to you know, damage control. And the point we made was that once Reyes made the confessions, they knew they had a match that didn't an unidentified match. 3 months later, same MO, same area, they never connected it. And I think it goes to the point that Michael was making from the book, that Reyes's profile was totally contrary to the scenario that they had concocted to convict these young men. And to accept Reyes's story would mean that there was no basis for what they had done, and that these young men were unjustly convicted. We cannot look at what happened to these young men, and this is it's a national question as well, not just a New York City question, because it speaks to the issue of race in the United States. That the statement that the Supreme Court justice made in the Dred Scott decision in 1857, that a Negro has no rights which a white man need respect, exists to this day. And in 1989 was a clear example of that, that a young, white, well-to-do woman was attacked, was beaten in a terrible crime, and it didn't matter which black or Latino was going to get convicted, but somebody was going to get convicted for that. And I think that's the context in which all of the different particulars get played out, and what's happening now is that the truth is forcing its way out, and the district attorney's hesitation and stalling in conducting this, coming forth with their conclusions, because the facts are very clear, we think are really them trying to see how do we minimize the damage, how do we explain to the families of people who were killed after the Central Park case, when this guy was still around, where we dropped the ball, how do we repair what the damage that was done to these young men's lives, to their families. I mean, this has a ripple effect, and to the fact that one news article said yesterday that, well, what could they get out of it now since they've already finished jail? What could they get out of it aside from having their names exonerated, as if that's nothing? And I think that's what we're dealing with here in this case, is that these young men have been damaged. They can't get back the time they spent in jail, but they certainly can have their names exonerated. They can be removed from the sex offender list, which trails them their entire lives. And so that's why we're doing this case. That's what the significance of it. I think it pulls the covers on the so-called criminal justice system, not only in New York City but around the country, when it comes to the question of how blacks and Latinos are treated once we get inside that system.
Yeah, there's another connection that they're working very strenuously to create, and that is
Councilmember Bill Perkins.
The connection between Matias Reyes and the five defendants. They visited the defendants' homes to show them pictures and see if they know Matias Reyes. When they visited the defendants' homes, they did not even know that the report in the Times had come out indicating that Matias Reyes had confessed to the crime. They visited unannounced, showed the families a set of pictures, one of which included him, and asked, "Do you know anybody in these pictures?" They reacted, "No, we don't know anybody in these pictures," and then subsequently found out why those district attorney detectives came to their homes.
So they had never told them that he had confessed.
They had never told them. They didn't even tell them why they came.
In other words, what they're trying to do now is a fallback theory that Matias committed the attack, but that the other teenagers were present with him.
Exactly.
And that, in other words, that he's telling the truth about one aspect of it in his new confession, but not about the other,
alone. But they've been so devious about this, they even went to Santana, who's in prison now for another unrelated charge, and in the same manner show him the pictures to see if he knew what was going on, if he knew Matias.
What?
And he didn't know what was going on either, and found out that they had brought Matias Reyes down to the same prison that he was in to see if they would bump into each other and make some kind of connection. They brought Matias Reyes down to Raymond Santana's prison, unbeknownst to Raymond, to see if they would, interact. So there's been a very devious effort on their part to try to establish a connection between Matias Reyes and the defendants, and they don't know each other. In fact, in yesterday's paper, they try to make a claim that Corey and Matias were in jail at one time together and had a fight about the case. But the fact of the matter is that the fight that they had nothing to do with the case. It had to do with what very often happens in jail, a fight about what channel the TV is going to be on.
He confessed, Matias Reyes, in January. When was he DNA tested?
I don't know precisely, Amy, but on the basis of information we have, it was around June.
It took 5 months.
Of this year, correct. But he was brought down here in May of this year. He was here for 3 days. He took them to Central Park and pointed out specifically where the attack occurred. He pointed out where he was initially. He took them through the entire scenario of what occurred that night.
And why did he do this?
Well, he did it because, according to Matias Reyes, he's got religion. And when he ran into Corey Wise for the second time, very briefly, up at Auburn Penitentiary, he had begun to be a follower of the Christian faith. And he said, "Look, I cannot live with myself for what I have done. I have allowed innocent victims to in his words, to go down for something that I did." And so at that point, he decided that he was going to come forward. And he came forward. And when you listen to him, he's very, very graphic about what took place and very affirmative that he acted alone. In fact, we obviously want the relief that is requested in the motion, setting aside the verdict. But I think it's important here for everybody, for all of us, to have a hearing so that Matias Reyes comes down and you all, the press and the public, the community, who has been so embroiled with this case all these years, can hear this man describe what he did and what he did alone. And it will be quite impressive, I'm sure.
And the hearing is going to be before Judge Eduardo Padro,
who
I know very well. Yeah,
from the neighborhood.
From the neighborhood, who is from that neighborhood.
Now I found this out yesterday. I had a meeting with the chief clerk, and for some reason, because of a new system, allegedly, the hearing will not be on Monday the 9th now. It will be set back until probably the 17th or 18th. I won't know until at the earliest Tuesday. I'll be calling the chief clerk. She will let me know when the hearing will take place, but it won't be on Monday at 9:30.
Well, given all the attention that's going to be placed on the September 11th activities, it's probably better to postpone it
so that
there'll be full press attention
to it.
That's
right. It's fine.
Now, the Times sort of saying what do they have to gain, but since they've already served their time, but the overturning commission, let's just talk about, among many other things, Megan's Law. These five young men now, Kari Weiss just came out 30.
Right.
He went in at 16. He comes out at 30. They now fall under that federal law. Is that right?
They all are now under Megan's Law. They all are now required to.
They're sex offenders.
They're sex offenders, publicly identified and having to report regularly. And take different types of courses related to that.
Pictures on the internet, neighbors
so
alerted.
And whenever
they go to a new jurisdiction, they're required to report to the authorities in that jurisdiction, whether it be another town or a state or whatever, that they're there.
And every time their picture is in the paper, they lose a job.
They lose
friends and whatnot. So it's a very, very serious situation for them in terms of their daily life, in terms of moving on with their lives and being able to gainfully be employed and have relationships with people in the normal way that most of us take for granted.
And Roger Wareham, I'd like to ask you, in terms of this, because we've also been doing stories about the Los Angeles Police Department destroying all the DNA evidence that could possibly exonerate people who are already in jail, the importance of continuing to utilize DNA evidence to look back at past convictions, especially given the notorious unreliability of so many prosecutors and police departments in terms of the people that they choose to follow through on particular crimes.
Yeah, I think it's indisputable the importance of DNA, particularly because even at this point with the DNA evidence in. We've gotten questions from the press, but they confessed, as if confessions aren't coerced, elicited, manipulated. I think the point was made, it might have been Barry Check made the point the other day, of several people who've been on death row, who would have been executed already, DNA exonerated them from the crimes of which they were convicted, and there were confessions in many of them. So I think that's why I said that this case raises the whole question of how the criminal justice system works, and we've got to, you know, utilize the new scientific methods and in the same way keep the pressure on law enforcement not to do what is happening in LA in terms of destroying the evidence. The science helps expose the illegalities that they're involved in. So what do? They end run it. They destroy the evidence. So I think we hope that this is a clarion call, not only for the exoneration of these young men, but for people to be very clear around how the criminal justice system works and the importance of citizens to demand that the people whose tax money pays for them adhere to the so-called democratic ideals which supposedly drive the society.
Well, Roger Wareham, Michael Tarif Warren, and Councilmember Bill Perkins, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We'll certainly continue to follow this case. And if people want to get information on a videotape or audio cassette CD of this program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. When we come back, we're going to continue talking about DNA evidence. And we're going to talk about one of the largest DNA data banks in this country and what it has to do, believe it or not, with the stolen election of 2000 and the NAACP settling a lawsuit in Florida related to both the private company and the state and the national elections. Stay with us.
It's the people who made America great. It's the people who are the electorate. My people gave me Florida on a silver plate. I trust the people. Oh, the people they earn with the sweat of their toil. Sometimes the people the earth do despoil. My people, they do it with petroleum oil. I trust the people. trust the people through and through. I don't trust the government, and neither should you. I trust the people compassionately. Now I'm the government. Can I trust me?
I Trust the People, Greg Artzner and Terry Leonino. Here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we talk about the importance of DNA evidence in the Central Park jogger case, we're going to take a close look at one of the technology companies involved. ChoicePoint operates the nation's largest private DNA database. It's offered its DNA testing services to the Innocence Project, which works to free wrongly convicted individuals on death row. It's also led the campaign to help police departments to test backlogged rape kits. The company's database contains over 15 billion public records. The company has been described as society's ultimate search engine. But ChoicePoint doesn't just work to free innocent people from prison. ChoicePoint is also the private company behind the stolen election of 2000 and has recently reached a settlement with the NAACP over its role in illegally purging African Americans from the Florida voter rolls. Florida's top elections officials and the NAACP announced on Tuesday they've settled a lawsuit over voting rights violations during the 2000 presidential election.
The class action lawsuit alleged Florida election officials systematically kept African Americans away from the voting booths by illegally purging them from voter rolls, improperly handling their registrations so they did not appear on voter lists, or by simply turning them away from the polling places. The suit also alleged the private company ChoicePoint knowingly mislabeled innocent voters as felons under Florida law. Convicted felons cannot vote. The two sides say the settlement will build on the Florida Election Reform Act of 2001, which included changes in registration list maintenance, provided funding for improved voter education and poll worker training, and created alternative voting and registration procedures. But tens of thousands of voters who were illegally purged from the voting rolls 2 years ago will still have problems voting this fall because the voter rolls have not yet been corrected. So we're going to discuss that now.
That's right. We're joined by a number of people to talk about DNA evidence, the stolen election, and the company ChoicePoint. We're going to begin with Greg Palast. He's the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. It's great to have you back, Greg.
Terrific to be on. By the way, was that you and Jim Hightower singing that song about the people? That was terrific. Got a great voice. Yeah.
Greg, you are an investigative reporter. You have reported for the BBC for years and the London Guardian. It's nice to have you back on this side of the Atlantic. Can you talk about ChoicePoint?
Yeah, in fact, it's interesting. By the way, congratulations on one thing. I was on Phil Donahue last night. He said, how come this story about the voter purge was not in the U.S. papers? You know, I told him before the show, and I said, well, you should listen to Democracy Now, and you get it all. What happened was in the years leading up to the election, but especially 5 months before the election, the Florida Republican government, under the direction of Catherine Harris and her predecessor under Jeb Bush, ordered the purge of thousands of voters. And I thought originally, by the way, it was about 57,700. My understanding from ChoicePoint's latest confession, it was up to 94,000 people were targeted to have their voting rights removed on the grounds that they were evildoers, felons, murderers, father rapers, mother stabbers, that type of thing, and they can't vote in Florida. As it turns out, and Anita Hodgkins, the NAACP, is on, she can confirm some of this. I had estimated that the list with BBC television, I got a hold of the list. We cracked it. It's about 95% wrong. So I figured about 50,000 people. Now it looks like over 90,000 people were wrongly tagged to have their voting rights removed. Now, they weren't completely innocent because in the list of 57,000, a little over half were African American, were black people, and some Hispanics. The bigger list is something like 40%. But if you do the voting demographics, if you talk to experts like David Bositis, if you do the demographics, you got 93% of the black voters would have voted for Al Gore. A little less than half more than half the white voters would have voted for Al Gore as well, that they knocked off. So it was like an overwhelmingly Democratic list. And what happened was this Choice Point gave them this bogus, phony list. Choice Point's a Republican-connected firm. They took $4 million from the state treasury. No other state has done this. They replaced a firm that was paid $5,000 to do this work. They got $4 million to come up with this completely phony list. And the way that they did it is they came up with a bad list. They gave it to the state, and basically, because we have the internal emails from the state, we have the internal documentation, it said, these guys said, look, this. They basically said, this is our first pass. These are people who have names similar to people in Florida and birthdays similar to and race matching people in Florida. But of this list, this includes people who aren't felons. In other words, these people are mostly it's people who are innocent. And we will use our big databases to tell you who in this list is actually a felon. At most, at absolute stone most, out of 94,000 people, there are 3,000 matches. 3,000 out of 94,000. But what happened was the state officials looked at this list and saw a Democratic voter list. And they basically said, and I have handwritten notes, literally, when it said, you know, when Choice Point says, we're going to take all these steps to cut down this list by basically by 95, 97%. Don't need. We have letters, panic letters from clerks saying, you know, we've got people convicted in the future. I found, the first name I found was Thomas Cooper's convicted in the year 2007. Well, it turns out the list I looked at, there were 500 people convicted in the future. And the records were a complete mess. These were innocent people. These weren't felons. Listen, if you vote, if you're a felon voter in Florida and you vote, you committed another felony, you go right back to jail. Not many people are willing to do that, certainly not 50 or 90,000 people. What Choice Point had done was named the crime wave, didn't exist.
Greg, if I can, what I'd like to do is try to bring in Anita Hotchkiss.
That's right. The lead plaintiff. I just want to tell you, this company, Choice Point, the main perpetrators here, the perps, were Catherine Harris, Jeb Bush, Clayton Roberts, their elections officials. The problem we have with Choice Point is that this company, for money, went along with a political fix. They completely went along with this fix, and that's the danger. If they went along with what Jeb Bush wanted them to do, what will they do when George Bush tells them what to do, which breaks the law?
Well,
they're lawbreakers.
Okay,
let
me bring in Anita Hotchkiss, who's a lead plaintiff and attorney with the NAACP, director of the Lawyers Committee Voting Rights Project. Could you talk to us about your settlement and why you decided to settle with your lawsuit?
Yes, thank you. I worked with the NAACP. I was actually an attorney, not a plaintiff. The NAACP was our plaintiff. We settled with Choice Point back in June because they agreed to reprocess the data in a way that we thought would be helpful to us in pursuing the case against the state. And we also, just to be clear, Choice Point bought Database Technologies, DBT, after the November 2000 election, and it was DBT that actually did all this work. So while legally Choice Point was responsible, and many of the same employees are still who were employees of DBT are now employees of Choice Point, but it was this Database Technologies company, which interestingly had head offices in Texas. But be that as it may, we did settle with Choice Point. They reran the lists for us, gave us very valuable information about what you would get if you ran this kind of data matching using criteria that are more reliable. Even given the fact that the data you're using is unreliable, there's a way to come up with useful information by, weeding out the unreliable data.
But is it true right now? Here you have Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush, now candidates, Catherine Harris for Congress, Jeb Bush for governor, and the voter rolls have not been fixed.
That's right. The legislature had the opportunity twice to pass laws that would require the state to go back and correct the many mistakes that they made, and they failed to do that, which is why we continued pursuing our litigation. The settlement does require the state to go back and both at the state level and at the local level re-examine anyone who was purged using these lists who didn't match on every item.
I guess Jeb Bush has learned what worked for his brother will work for him. But I want to bring Karen Palmer into the conversation, founding member of Rainbow Sisters Project. She's a rape survivor herself. Now bring in the part of the story that is has not gotten any attention, and that is Choice Point. And in addition to being involved with taking over the company that purged the voter rolls, the database, the DNA database that it keeps, Karen.
Well, Choice Point also owns Bode, which is a DNA testing lab, one of the leading ones in the United States. And they've gotten involved in a lot of different things. A lot of the things have actually been positive. One of them is helping free innocent people from prison through doing DNA evidence. And also they've set up this group called that was on featured on 2020 last week called rapeevidence.org. Unfortunately, 2020 failed to make the connection with Choice Point and promoted this website, which is unfortunate because when you go to that website, it links to Choice Point, and it talks about, it has an article, the interview with the CEO of Choice Point, and he says some things that I think are very disturbing. And
so first, they failed to make the connection that Choice Point is the one that was involved with the Florida, taking over the company.
Right.
Right.
And then they paid, 2020 paid for a police department to do testing and, you know, did not reveal some of the more controversial aspects of the organization that they were involved with. They failed to disclose that, including the positions of the CEO of Choice Points, who said in a recent article...
The Choice Point CEO is named Derek Smith.
Derek Smith. This article is entitled Brave New World, which kind of says it all, and it was published in Georgia Trend magazine in August. It says some of the quotes were, "Perhaps the most accumulated burden of disturbing information that flows like a virus in his blood," referring to Derek Smith. "A recent Choice Point survey suggested 25% of pizza delivery drivers have been incarcerated in the 4 months preceding the study. What pizza do you like?" Smith asked rhetorically. "At what price are you willing to take the risk associated with dealing with a company who doesn't screen their drivers?" I mean, but he goes on and talks about 9/11 and these evildoers and his connection with Howard Safer, the former police commissioner of New York. I mean, they do...
Howard Safer, who's the biggest proponent for Choice Point as a paid consultant for gathering this national database, DNA database.
Correct. And he was the one that was working very closely with 2020 to do this piece. So, they admit in this piece their connection to what happened in Florida, but they also talk about... about all foreigners entering the United States having to give up their DNA evidence.
Well, we have to leave it there, but we are going to continue to follow the story. It is an explosive one. Karen Palmer, Greg Pallast, Anita Hotchkiss, lead plaintiff attorney in the NAACP versus Harris case. I want to thank you all for being with us. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a video or audio cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. I'm very much looking forward to going to the First Baptist Church tonight in Los Angeles for a big fundraiser for KPFK tomorrow at Golden Gate Park in San Francisco with Michael Franti and others. I know it'll be broadcast on KPFA, and I'm looking forward to that. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, and Alex Wolf. Mike DiFilippo is our engineer and music maestro, sitting in for Anthony Sloan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!